Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend, with Robert Louis Abrahamson here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Your city, your home, right? Because that's our theme for this evening, Under Lamplight, home. Why home? You may recall that on the last show we heard the Fraggles telling us that you don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound. And I started thinking about this. You don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound. We need to play with an example. Let's say I take the train to, well, let's say Edinburgh. I arrive at Edinburgh. Surely I know where I am, don't I? But perhaps that's only a name, Edinburgh. I can locate myself on a map, but where I am is more than just where I am located. As you remember Walt Whitman said, I am not contained between my hat and boots. There's more to me than that. A recent talk with Vivian from Amherst reminded me that we can distinguish between an event and an experience. An event, at least as I defined it in our discussion, is something that just occurs, something on the material level. I boarded a train in Cambridge. I read and napped in a seat facing west with the occasional sunshine lighting up the pages. I got out of the train in Edinburgh. I walked up the Waverley steps to Prince's Street. I met Ian for dinner at that nice restaurant on Hanover Street, and so on. These are events. But an experience describes an event that changes us in some way. If I just go through the motions, have a nice enough time, but basically remain the same throughout, my time there has been an event, but not an experience. If you just have events, then, well, you'll always be able to know where you've been, but who cares? Except maybe your accountant or the police if you want to prove an alibi. So what matters is having an experience, having been changed in some way by an event. And it is this change that defines where we have been. Sometimes we know immediately that something has changed us. We suddenly see everything in a different way. We even seem to move around with a different kind of rhythm, a different vibration. Event has become experience. Sometimes we need other people to point out that we have changed. But sometimes we don't know where we've been until we're homeward bound. In other words, when we head back to where we had been, we can then perceive the difference in ourselves and know we've been changed by some experience. We know where we have been in an alchemical alembic, being transformed somehow. What are you looking forward to now? How do you feel about the old folks back home? Do you feel less patient than before? Or more patient, more open and accepting? Or maybe just bored, reluctant and resentful? Examine these things as you travel home and learn where you have just been. But suppose you're not homeward bound, but bound to somewhere else. Can you still know where you've been? Or does this backward reflection occur only if we're in sight of home, whatever that may mean? Suppose you no longer have a home. Well, let's leave these questions for now, but I do want to keep our sights on home. Let's not get too intellectual about this all. I have a handful of songs, poems, and stories on the theme of home to which I invite you to attend. Let's look at the journey away from home and then back home again. Maybe the songs, poems, and stories will open up some more of the resonance of this mythic home imagery. But before we look at the act of leaving home, we first need to face the problem of holdfast. That mythic character Joseph Campbell identified that keeps us held fast at home, afraid to venture out into the unknown. When home becomes a wasteland, a place where we just follow safe routine in a state of inertia, not growing, just existing, then sometimes we are called on a journey away from this home, symbolically out into some world of challenges, but really deep into the world within us. We are given the chance to answer this calling or refuse it. At this point, we often encounter Holdfast, who provides us with excuses, often very good ones, to stay back from the journey calling us. Holdfast often thinks, in fact, that he is acting in our best interests. Remember Little Red Riding Hood's mother telling her to stay on the familiar path through the woods? That's good practical advice, but it's a sure way to keep the girl from venturing out into womanhood. You may remember that when Obi-Wan Kenobi asks Luke to come with him to rescue Princess Leia, Luke pulls back. He has to help his uncle bring in the harvest. "I can't get involved," Luke protests. "I've got work to do. It's not that I like the Empire. I hate it, but there's nothing I can do about it right now. It's all such a long way from here." "That's your uncle talking," Obi-Wan says, and for uncle, we might just say Holdfast. And that's it. Luke has refused the calling, even though his heart actually yearns to leave the farm and enroll in the academy. Luke chose duty over the calling, an honorable choice, but not the one that was right for him. When he returns home, though, he discovers the home is a literal wasteland. The Empire's people have burned the place and killed his uncle and aunt. Holdfast is gone. The adventure waits. It is always painful to break from Holdfast, but the alternative is never to grow. And then there was the man who wanted to follow Jesus, but he said he first had to go bury his father. "Let the dead bury their dead," Jesus replied. That's a pretty tough line, you'll agree, but maybe our discussion of Holdfast helps us understand what he meant. Campbell says that one of the main tasks of the mature hero, back from the journey, is to get rid of the Holdfast holding back others in the wasteland. And our first song takes a complicated look at Holdfast and the refusal to leave home. It's Shangri-La from the Kinks album Arthur, which celebrates the ordinary Londoner, content and obedient, loyal to queen and country. Working-class Arthur has successfully made the northern migration from the devastated East End out to the new London suburban world of identical houses to live out the rest of his life in the kind of comfort he could only dream of back in the old neighbourhood. Here's your reward for working so hard. Gone are the lavatories in the backyard. That's it, Arthur. There's your reward. You never questioned authority, you never ventured beyond the world you were put into, and now you can graduate from outdoor toilets to indoor loos. The little man, that's all they are, little men. The little man who gets the train got a mortgage hanging over his head, but he's too scared to complain, 'cause he's conditioned that way. Time goes by and he pays off his debts, got a TV set and a radio for 7 shillings a week. 7 shillings, that's 35 pence in today's money. Higher purchase payments in the days before credit cards. And Ray's voice is so clear, so tender towards Arthur, and so supportive, until in the bridge he suddenly modulates into a much harder, mocking voice, identifying the London suburb as a true wasteland. And all the houses in the street have got a name, 'cause all the houses in the street, they look the same. Same chimney pots, same little cars, same window panes. The gas bills and the water rates and payments on the car, too scared to think about how insecure you are. Life ain't so happy in your little Shangri-La. And then the mocking chorus, Shangri-La, la, 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 la. Carefree? Hardly. And Shangri-La, the name of Arthur's house, was, after all, the Himalayan paradise in the novel Lost Horizons, an ideal place where aging slowed down and all was serene. But once anyone left the sacred place, that person would rapidly age and die. Arthur may be secure in his little semi-detached, but it's a kind of living dead. Get ready for a wonderful song.
Now that you've found your paradise, this is your kingdom to command. You can go outside and polish your car. I'll sit by the fire in your Shangri-La. Here's your reward for working so hard. Gone are the lavatories in the backyard. Gone are the days when you dreamed of that car. You just want to sit in your Shangri-La. Put on your slippers and sit by the fire. You've reached your top and you just can't get any higher. You're in your place and you know where you are, in your Shangri-La. Sit back in your old rocking chair. $7 a week.
La la la.
Wasn't that wonderful? The Kinks at their most vibrant. Well, Arthur has found some sort of contentment, even if it means remaining a little man stuck in the wasteland. But others cannot stay in their homes. They may be kicked out by poverty, war, oppression. They might become wanderers, nomads, or, as we call them today, homeless people. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. We're back in the world of the Grapes of Wrath with Woody Guthrie's Ain't Got No Home, giving voice to these people, holding up their heads despite it all.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Was a farming on the shares, and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Now as I look around, it's mighty plain to see, this world is such a great and a funny place to be. All the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
But some people choose to defy holdfast and willingly venture out, become explorers, like our Fraggle friend Gobo, bravely facing the world beyond his snug Fraggle home. But when his explorations are over, he's not sure how to get back home. Being a Fraggle, he's wise enough to know that the only way to find your way is through playfulness. His song, Only Way Home, is a short song and a catchy song, both the words and the music. Well, you go one way. See, it's some kind of fun way. Start exploring the two way. Wow, it's just like a through way. When you get to the three way, can't be sure it's a free way. Got to find me the true way. That's the only way home. That's the words. Now for the music.
It's great being an explorer. Headed down the road, I'm going round and round. Walking through the light and through the free and easy land. All I want to know is how the world goes round. All I want to be is a traveling, be a wandering man. Will you go one way? See, it's some kind of fun way. Start exploring the two way. Wow, it's just like a through way. When when you get to the freeway. Can't be sure it's a freeway. Got to find me the true way. That's the only way home. Well, you go one way, see it's some kind of fun way. Start exploring the two way. Wow, it's just like a throughway. When you get to the freeway, can't be sure it's a freeway. Got to find me the true way. That's the only way home. La 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 la.
Well, I suppose if you're lost and far from home, maybe with no hope of ever getting back home, or not able to face home, or like Luke Skywalker, having home destroyed, maybe then this song won't be very catchy. But I suspect that if you've lost your playfulness, you've lost more than just your direction home. Next, here's a poem about a man who found his way home at the end of his life, though whether it was his true home and whether they would actually take him home provide the debate that takes up most of the poem. I'm referring to Robert Frost's Death of the Hired Hand. There are two main characters, Mary and Warren, a settled, married couple living on their small farm, presumably in New England. They are the only characters we see or hear. Then there is Silas, the hired hand, who has returned as if to his home. He remains off stage, inside the house during the action of the poem, while Mary and Warren conduct their conversation on the steps of the porch outside. And finally, there is Harold Wilson. No overtones of the British Prime Minister when this poem was written earlier in the 20th century. Wilson's a college kid who worked on the farm as a hired hand during his summer vacation. This is a narrative poem, which means it tells a story, even though the story comes to us mostly through the dialogue, and is more about relationships than actual events. Here's what happens. Warren comes back from a trip into town, and Mary rushes out to the porch to catch him before he goes inside. Silas has returned, she tells him, that old farmhand whom they used to hire when there was need for more laborers on the farm. Be kind, Mary says, knowing that Warren is still angry at Silas. When was I ever anything but kind? Warren replies, but I'll not have the fella back. I speak the lines as Frost does, in a kind of monotone jog-trot rhythm. He can't forgive Silas for leaving right in the middle of last year's haymaking. Mary and Warren go back and forth about how to receive Silas, who is alarmingly ill. Mary says Warren would be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that, Warren says. I haven't been, she replies. Go, look, see for yourself. Warren goes in to see him, but comes out again fairly quickly. Silas is dead. Who is this Silas, and in what sense has he returned home? Silas was a good worker, but liable to go off for better pay somewhere else just when you most needed him for a job on the farm. Silas has returned while Warren is in town, and promised to marry, at last to carry out those long-postponed tasks, dredge the meadow and clear the upper pasture. His only self-respect comes from his offer to do this work, but both he and Mary know he's not up to it anymore. His mind runs on about young Harold Wilson, the college boy. Silas just couldn't see the point of all his book learning, especially the fact that Harold was studying Latin, like the violin, because he liked it. That an argument? Silas is haunted by the desire to impart something really useful, something really valuable to Harold, such as how to load hay onto a wagon in such a way that it won't make a mess when unloading it at the other end, a skill Silas is particularly good at. But here he is at the end of his life, with nothing to show for it. He never hurt anyone, but he's just not respectable, and certainly would be turned out if ever he went to his rich brother, the banker. He has no home, except for this one farm that has always before taken him in. Home? And here comes the most famous lines of the poem. Mary says, Warren, he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time. Home? Warren mocks gently, and Mary replies, "Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us, any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out upon the trail." Warren says, "Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in." Mary says, "I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." Warren's definition, "home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in," is overweighed by have-tos. Home seems to be a place associated with reluctance and compulsion. Mary's emphasis on home as something you somehow haven't to deserve is much more tentative, something, somehow, and the opposite of have-to, haven't to. It's just there for you. It's a place where, unlike anywhere else, you are accepted for yourself. Maybe home, therefore, is the place you go to in order to discover who you really are. So you not only don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound, but you don't even know who you are until you're welcomed at home. But enough of me. Here's Robert Frost with his gruff New England way of reading his own poetry, giving us the story of the death of the hired hand.
Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table, waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. "Silas is back." She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. "Be kind," she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. "When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back," he said. "I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then," I said, "that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes, always, when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg or be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that were what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time, when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done." "Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you," Mary said. "I want him to. He'll have to, soon or late." "He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. A miserable sight. And frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him. And he's changed. Wait till you see." "Where did you say he'd been?" "He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off." "What did he say? Did he say anything?" "But little. Or anything. Mary, confess he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me." "Warren." "But did he? I just want to know." "Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer, to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson. You remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school, teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to have him back. He says they, too, will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. The way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson, a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun. Silas up on the cart to build the load, Harold along beside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days troubled Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would. How some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold's saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know. That's Silas' one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches like big birds' nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now, and never any different. Part of a moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw it, and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. "Warren," she said, "he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time." "Home," he mocked gently. "Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back and broke it in his hand and tossed it by. "Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles as the road winds would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, or somebody, director in the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to that if there is need. He ought to write to take him in, and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances. But have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he had any pride in claiming kin or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you, Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind that kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anybody. Worthless though he is, he won't be made ashamed to please his brother. And I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart, the way he lay and rolled his old head on that sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made the bed up for him there tonight. You'll be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go look, see for yourself. But, Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. Then there were three there making a dim row, the moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned. Too soon, it seemed to her. Slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. "Warren," she questioned. "Dead," was all he answered.
I wondered again. to my home in the mountain, where in youth early dawn I was happy and free. I look for my friend, but I never could find him. I found they were all rank strangers to me. Everybody I met seemed to be a rank stranger. No mother or dad, not a friend could I see. They knew not my name, and I knew not their faces. I found they were all rank strangers to me. They'd all moved away. That beautiful shore by the bright crystal sea. Some beautiful day I'll meet them in heaven, where no one will be your stranger to me. Everybody mother or dad, not a friend could I see. They knew not my name, and I knew not their faces. I found they were all rank strangers to me.
We followed Robert Frost reading his poem Death of the Hired Man with Bob Dylan's searing cover of Rank Strangers to Me. I wandered again to my home in the mountain, but it was no longer my home. Everybody I met seemed to be a rank stranger. They knew not my name, and I knew not their faces. I found they were all rank strangers to me. You can find this track on the 1988 album Down in the Groove. And you can find us here at Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, with your host here, Robert Louis Abrahamson. This evening we're looking at home, exploring the Fraggles line, "You don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound." The Death of the Hired Man and Rank Stranger to Me offer us some versions of homecoming. Here's the story of another homecoming, a parable, in fact, sometimes known as the parable of the prodigal son. It's a story presumably told by Jesus and retold for us by Luke, the most sophisticated writer in the New Testament. Let's take the story in sections. One of Luke's strengths is his reliance on the older Hebrew method of storytelling, which alternated between dialogue and very swift narration, usually presented as a succession of ands. The story begins in a domestic scene between father and his younger son, with a short dialogue and then a narrative rushing us through a succession of events. A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me." And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. That's the first movement of the story. From a secure and nurturing home out into the big world. Asking his father for his share of the inheritance is an insult. It's almost the same thing as saying to his father, "You're dead to me now. I want to take what I can from you and leave." But notice that the father immediately divides his wealth and gives the son what he asks for. Prodigal means spendthrift, wasteful. And we might wonder here, who exactly is the prodigal in this story, the son or the father? Well, the father and the older son are now presumably poorer, poorer by half, maybe. But the father puts up no objections. Henry Nguyen says that it's as if the father is saying, "Go and you'll be hurt and it will be painful, but when you come back, I'm there for you. I'm there for you now." The son goes off into a world of potential self-discovery, but is diverted into a life of riotous living. He wastes it all, as though there's nothing else we can do with worldly goods selfishly desired but waste them. And then he finds himself destitute, worse off than the despised pigs. Serves the kid right, many people would say today, taking some sort of mean delight in watching someone else's downfall, happy to blame the other person, instead of recognizing that this pigsty is a place we all find ourselves in at some point or another. Whether it's our own fault or not does not matter. What matters is what we do next. This wastrel then comes to himself. I've always liked that phrase. Where was he before? Was he somewhere else than with himself? Did he need to end up at the bottom of the heap before he came to himself? Well, in any case, that's what happened. And when he came to himself, he said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants." And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. There's the genius of Luke's writing. The writing is so sparse, but the succession of ands creates the fast pace and also a sense of urgency, as though events cannot happen fast enough for this father. His father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the father started these actions while the son was yet a great way off. Just a few words here, but I think they suggest a much larger picture. Has this father been keeping watch for his son all the time that the son has been away? Maybe it's been years. Has he maybe expected him, or was he maybe just keeping himself on the alert, available for whenever that son might come back? We, in our weakness, would say to the kid on his return, "See, I knew you'd be back when you'd had enough." But that would just make the son feel put down, and his loving father would never do that. And now the son presents his rehearsed lines. We don't know if the son is actually repentant or is just a very good performer working out the best way to gain his father's sympathy. Both interpretations are plausible, and it's typical of the biblical writers that we are not told anything for certain, as though they were wise enough to let us work it out for ourselves and balance our reading over several possibilities. The Bible is not dogmatic, you see, despite what many loud voices tell us. It's not dogmatic. It's literary. But the father does not let the son finish his prepared speech. Words are irrelevant now. What is called for is action, joyous action to celebrate. And the son said unto him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son." But the father said to his servants, bring forth the best robe, and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf, and kill it, and let us eat, and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. If we are alert to the feel of Hebrew poetry, which is often inserted into stories at the moments of greatest intensity, we can see that the father has crowned his joy by moving into verse two parallel statements of opposites, dead, alive, lost, found. This seems like the end of the story, but Luke doesn't tell stories like that. He gives us what has been called a midterm crisis, a turning point in the middle of the story, where the plot suddenly veers in a different direction, pursuing a related theme. And here the camera suddenly cuts to the third person in this family, whom we haven't yet seen, the older son, the stay-at-home, doing the right thing by his father and the farm. But somehow Holdfast seems to have dried up his soul. Not having been broken by the riotous living and pigsty disgrace, the son begrudges any act of gratuitous generosity, that is, any act springing from love. He wants justice, not mercy. Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said unto him, Thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound. And he was angry, and would not go in. Therefore came his father out, and entreated him. Notice that. The father comes out to him just as he had gone out to the younger brother. And here's the son's sulky, self-righteous reply. And he answering said to his father, Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf. And he said unto him, Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was meet that we should make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found. Waterboy's Carolyn's welcome saw out our reading of the parable of the prodigal son. You noticed, of course, the way Luke repeated the poem at the end to give a final climax to the story. But every time something is repeated in the Bible, there is always a variation, and the significance lies in that variation. First, the father had said, My son was dead and is alive again. Now, in the context of urging his older son to be more compassionate, he shifts to saying, Thy brother was dead and is alive again. And did this younger son find out where he'd been only when he was homeward bound? We never know. We're never told his response to his father's outpouring of love, but he certainly learned that home is something that somehow we haven't to deserve, since he surely hasn't deserved this kind of welcome. Where has he been, then? Maybe we can say he's out in the world preparing himself for this lesson about unconditional love, becoming vulnerable so he could be open to his father's open arms. And one more selection before we give a few final moments to Walt Whitman. Here's another strange song from Leonard Cohen, Going Home, from his 2012 album, Old Ideas, an album of old age. Going home here carries associations of that final home, the home Silas has found at the end of life. Going home to where it's better than before. Going home without my burden. Going home behind the curtain. Going home without the costume that I wore. This is a very Shakespearean conceit. All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. We play all these roles in life, not to be deceitful, but because that's the play we've been cast in. But we must not forget that it is a stage, a play, and we have a real self behind the roles we adopt. At the end of The Tempest, Prospero throws away the magical props he has used in his role as sorcerer, his magic cloak, his book of spells, his wand, and he releases the spirits he has had under his control. He is divesting himself of the things of his ego so that, like Leonard Cohen, he can go home without the costume that I wore. Every third thought, Prospero says, shall be my grave. That is, once he returns to his political home of Milan, he will prepare himself for his eternal home, his true self, though some might call it paradise. And so the song separates Leonard's role as Leonard Cohen in his suit, writing love songs and so on, and the deeper Leonard, still compassionate towards his ego self, but moving far beyond it. I love to speak with Leonard. He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit.
I love to speak with Leonard. He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit. But he does say what I tell him, even though it isn't welcome. He just doesn't have the freedom to refuse. He will speak these words of wisdom like a sage, a man of vision, though he knows he's really nothing but the brief elaboration of a tube. Going home without my sorrow, going home sometime tomorrow, going home to where it's better than before. Going home without my burden, going home behind the curtain, going home without the costume that I wore.
Sorrow, going home sometime tomorrow.
love to speak with Leonard. He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit.
Leonard Cohen, going home. But why are we doing all this? Are we attending to these poems and stories and songs just for entertainment or for some sort of lesson? Walt Whitman suggests something different. We attend to these things because they help us come home to ourselves. What I have assumed, Whitman says, remember, what I have assumed, you shall assume. Whitman's had the vision and has articulated it. Although it is an intensely personal vision, even egotistical, it is also, he is assured, universal. Whitman's perceptions of the way all of us are connected to each other, or Frost's, or Luke's, or Shakespeare's, or Leonard's perceptions, if they are true, then they must ring true for all of us. These are the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands, Whitman says. They are not original with me. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing or next to nothing. If they do not enclose everything, they are next to nothing. If they are not the riddle and the untying of the riddle, they are nothing. If they are not just as close as they are distant, they are nothing. So we attend to the words and the music and come home to ourselves and test how far we resonate with these universal insights. But being Walt Whitman, he cannot just leave it there. But in his exuberance, he has to expand the thought so it takes in all the specific people and things in the world. Listen to the whole of this short 17th section of Song of Myself, and let it resonate within you, or it is nothing. These are the thoughts of all men in all ages and lands. They are not original with me. If they are not yours as much as mine, they are nothing or next to nothing. If they do not enclose everything, they are next to nothing. If they are not the riddle and the untying of the riddle, they are nothing. If they are not just as close as they are distant, they are nothing. This is the grass that grows wherever the land is and the water is. This is the common air that bathes the globe. This is the breath of laws and songs and behavior. This is the tasteless water of souls. This is the true sustenance. It is for the illiterate. It is for the judges of the Supreme Court. It is for the federal capital and the state capitals. It is for the admirable communes of literary men and composers and singers and lecturers and engineers and savants. It is for the endless races of working people and farmers and seamen. Here's Harry James with Flying Home, and this has been Robert Louis Abrahamson with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. See you again next time. Good night. Leonard Cohen's song is about going home, which means really he's ready to die. And like Prospero in The Tempest, who at the end of the play gives up his ego, gives up all his activities. He was a sorcerer, a magician. And at the end of the play, he throws away his cloak, he throws his book and his staff into the sea, or breaks the staff, throws it into the sea, lets Ariel go free, his tame spirit, And he says, which is symbolic of giving up the ego. So he's just his pure self. And he would go home to Milan, and he was Duke of Milan, which we say by the meter. And he'll go home, and every third thought shall be my death. So he prepares himself for death. So he becomes an image, most of the play, of the powerful man. And then at the end, he becomes the man who puts it aside and gets ready for the end and gets in touch with his real self. And that's what Leonard Cohen is. I only just realized that. That's what this song is about. Everybody thinks it's just some funny song where he says, I love to speak with Leonard. He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard living in a suit. Great, funny lines. But that's the persona that he has put up, you know, wearing that suit all the time, the funny hat. And but he's ready now, thanks to all that Zen work, presumably, to cast that aside, but not entirely, because, of course, he's still in touch with that self. So he loves to talk with Leonard. And so he doesn't reject the ego, which is what we should be doing. We don't reject it. We just put it in its place and observe it and let it serve us instead of us serving the ego. And then you're ready to be homeward bound. Okay? That was good.
That was wonderful.